This is How Success Happens, where we talk to polar explorers, war correspondents, founders, ultramarathoners, authors, artists, and a range of other unique personalities to help you understand the capabilities behind how success happens.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
When I'm training for an ultramarathon, anywhere from 100 to 120 miles a week would be in my training cycle. Lots of miles.
You sold something like 250,000 books.
I'm the managing editor at entrepreneur.com and your host, Linda Lacina. Today, we have with us two founders of Cards Against Humanity, Ben Hantut and Max Temkin. Hi, guys.
Hi, Linda.
Hey, Linda.
You might know Cards Against Humanity as a profane, dark, and politically tinged party game. You might also know it for its pranks, like its Black Friday stunts that range from raising its prices to even sending people actual bullshit. You might even know them from the Super Bowl ad it ran one year that featured only a potato with the word advertisement on it. But you might not know that it funds a scholarship for women pursuing STEM careers and has raised millions for causes like internet privacy and government transparency. It might also surprise you that Cards Against Humanity for years had eight friends turned founders who kept their day jobs while running the card game as a side hustle. Today, we'll talk to Ben and Max on their unique approach to running a company. But first, a word from our sponsor. We'll start with a bit of trivia. In 1677, as I'm sure you all know, England passed something called the Statute of Frauds, which insisted that legal contracts must be in writing and signed. Well, that system then moved over to colonial America, and fast forward three centuries, we're all somehow doing the same thing on repeat. But at least there's now a better way to do it. Hallelujah. It's called Sign Easy. It's a simple, secure system for your business to digitally sign and distribute documents. You can scan and sign a document, have the system pass that document around to multiple people in whatever sequence you want, track the progress of that document, and even send reminders to the stragglers, the people who still need to put pen to paper, finger to screen. Can you imagine trying to explain this to the Parliament of 1677? Anyway, we today just call it the normal course of business. To get started for free, go to getsigneasy.com/podcast.
So anyway, guys, can you both maybe introduce yourselves and tell me a little bit about your roles at Cards Against Humanity?
Sure. My name is Max Temkin. I'm a designer from Chicago. I'm a co-creator of Cards Against Humanity. I don't know. What a fraught question to talk about our roles at Cards Against Humanity, because like, we all kind of do everything as a, among the partners, we all kind of do everything as a collective, but I'll let Ben introduce himself. Maybe he's figured this out better than I have.
It is always a difficult question to answer when people ask, what do you do at Cards Against Humanity? And the easiest answer for me to give is always, I run the production, because that is the one part of the company that I kind of have on lockdown. But Max is right that for the most part, every big decision we make is made by a consensus of the partners. I guess, beyond managing production, Max and I both co-manage the design of our products and all of our stunts and promotions, and sort of Max takes the lead on PR and marketing, and all the partners work together on all the writing for everything we do.
And let's talk a little bit about that sort of collective aspect, right? Which I think is really unusual and really interesting. So, you guys have you've been at this for years now, right? But and some of you have now gone full time, right? You both have, but there's still folks that are are in grad school. How do you run this as a collective? Like how does that function just logistically?
Well, we have one meeting a week with all of the partners where we make our sort of major business decisions, hiring and firing and approving big new projects and sort of doing creative brainstorming. And then we have a couple of retreats every year where we all kind of get together in real life. And mostly that's where we do creative work. So we work on writing the game itself. Everyone's remote. We all have an equal share of the company, so there's no hierarchy. No one's in charge of anyone else. We also generally try to make decisions by consensus. So we don't even necessarily vote on things. We kind of figure out solutions where there's unanimous support to proceed. So it's kind of a weird structure. I don't know that it's like prescriptive that other people should run their business in that way, but it works for us.
Yeah. You know, the group of us have all been friends, some of us since we were like literally in kindergarten. So there are a lot of relationships that run pretty deep and have gotten really complicated over the years. But it, you know, gives us sort of the opportunity to be just very, very, very straightforward and honest with each other when we're talking about what we think is a good idea, what we should do.
Sure. Yeah. And beyond that, right? Because relationships change, right? So even people that are good friends shouldn't be going into business with each other. Why do you think it works for you guys, just even beyond that fact that you just feel like you can be honest with each other? Why does it work?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that anyone has any meaningful insight into why what they're doing is successful. I mean, I think mostly it's like luck and privilege and being at the right place in the right time. And then everyone sort of like goes back and creates some kind of story that explains, you know, why they're successful.
Yeah, where
they're
like, I really couldn't agree more. Every time I listen to, you know, someone who started a business talk about how they did it, it's a lot of retconning.
It mostly just makes me feel like nobody knows what the fuck they're talking about. And they're always like, oh, I wake up in the morning, every morning I have a big bowl of oatmeal. And then I, started, you know, my successful airline. And if you too have a bowl of oatmeal, you could start a successful airline. It's like, well, you don't know what you're talking about. Like, you have no idea why it's successful. You got lucky and inherited some money or something. People often ask us how we came up with Cards Against Humanity. And the truth is I don't know that it's that interesting a story. I mean, it was like, we tried a lot of games and mostly they weren't very good and they didn't make us laugh. And then eventually we came up with a sort of primitive version of Cards Against Humanity, and that was fun to play and it did make us laugh, and then we kept working on it and we did lots and lots of versions and tried it over and over until it was really fun. But I know we've sort of sat around and we get asked this question so much and it's such a boring story. We've been asked, it's like, you know, oh, like hard work, and then we kept working on it until it was really good. It's not, I don't know that that's like satisfactory. I guess I don't know what people expect for that question, but we have sort of sat around and tried to write like juicier origin stories. So the one I remember was Eli was like, I should do an interview where when someone asked me how we came up with Cards Against Humanity, I say, oh, I was sleeping one night and a Navajo wind talker came in through my window and whispered into my ear, you should make a card game. It will do very well. And then he floated back out the window.
He should play that up. I think that's not a bad thing. Is it tiring for you guys to sort of to see those stories, knowing that so many of them have been maybe honed a little bit, and they're a little bit too shiny, and they really sort of make people feel like things are maybe a little less complicated than maybe they are?
Well, what do you I'm curious what you think, because this is, I mean, it's your show and you ask people these questions all the time. Why do you think people are interested in this sort of business origin story question?
I think because they want to be successful and they want to know what other people have done. And I think for a lot of people, it's inspiring, and it's also helpful because so much of entrepreneurship and so much of any sort of project is so lonesome. And folks don't always have a network in place when they're getting started. And so I think that some of these stories help people connect to a next step. It helps with their footfalls, you know? And so I think it helps with that, if that makes any sense, you know what I mean? But I also know that they can have a bad effect in some cases, because stories are stories, right? So the nature of storytelling is that it gets exaggerated and it gets simplified. And so it can be too easy just to think, well, anybody can start a startup out of their dorm room, and you don't think about maybe the seed money that they got from the guy who lived across the hall, right? You know, so it's
yeah. I think that's kind of what makes me skeptical of this whole genre of, like, you know, the garage startups story or whatever. Yeah, I heard this interview with Patton Oswalt the other day, the comedian, and he was talking about he was sort of trying to think about the rise of the superhero movie and sort of our current political climate and what he makes of that. And like, in some ways there's a kind of like despair to the superhero narrative, because I think everybody knows, like, you know, the world is so fucked up right now. And in so many ways it seems so hopeless and so rigged against ordinary people. And there's like no optimistic science fiction. Like, the liberal imagination is very muted right now. So what we come up with are these superhero stories where, like, literally, like, an alien lands on the planet and he's really strong and he solves all our problems. And, like, that's not a good plan of, like, what we do with society. So the fact that everyone sort of has retreated into these, like, superhero narratives as, like, a salvation story, there's, like, a feeling of despair with that, of, like, that's it. Like, some really strong outsider, like, comes in and punches the bad guy and fixes our problem. That's, like, what we've got. And I similarly feel like things are tough for people right now. You know, I think most people never really recovered from the 2008 collapse. I mean, I think there was some recovery on paper, but it didn't sort of go to ordinary people. It's really, there's great concentration of capital and power. There was this sort of radical democracy of social media and access to, like, people online, but that's starting to constrict in a really frightening and unequal way. And I think for all these people now who are trying to get their startup off the ground or start some project or just even make a living as, like, an artist, it's challenging and it looks bleak. Like, it doesn't look any better ahead. So I just get skeptical of these stories of, like, that we keep retelling the story of Steve Jobs. Like, that's like, oh, like, if you just learn to have the bowl of oatmeal every morning, that you can have a successful life. Like, I wonder if that's, like, you know, wanting to hear the story of Superman over and over instead of, like, confronting our problems as a society.
And, you know, it's like, speaking to the origin of Cards Against Humanity in particular, all eight of us come from relatively wealthy families in this very wealthy Jewish suburb of Chicago. And we were, you know, we had the luxury of putting almost nothing on the line when we sort of put some money into the beginnings of Cards Against Humanity, because we knew that if one of our lives totally unraveled because of issues with the business, that for the most part we could rely on our parents to help us. And, you know, it's not like we didn't borrow any money or anything like that to get the business going, but we had the privilege of having a cushion to fall back on that I think a lot of people just don't have when they're trying to start a business.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's also an important thing to acknowledge, because I think that there's many routes to entrepreneurship, and I don't think or just change or just personal, you know, projects. Like, and I think that it is easy for these things to be streamlined and to think, oh, well, no, I've got to be somebody who came from nothing, you know, and transform my life. I agree. And I think that for regular folks, it makes the division between maybe what they're working on and, you know, those types of companies, it makes that divide even greater. You know, there's already a divide between, like, sort of what's going on in Silicon Valley and New York, as far as, like, where funding goes and things like that. People are so removed from that. And stories like that make it all the more magical. It's like, oh gosh, like, there's this other world out there that maybe I can't even participate in. I might not even try.
Totally. I mean, there's also, like, one of the reasons that I've stayed in Chicago and I really love it here is there's this whole Chicago school that gets kind of overlooked. But, you know, that's very much in the vein of what Cards Against Humanity did, which is, like, you start really small. You know, maybe your project is a hobby for many years before, you know, it either turns into a job or doesn't, and you bootstrap and you don't take venture capital and you're not really worried about creating this whole perception of this whole grandiose project. And, you know, some of the companies that I look up to the most have been like right in that wheelhouse. So, like, you know, Field Notes and Basecamp and so many cool companies out here that are just kind of taking that more modest Midwestern approach.
I think one of the benefits for us of having taken that approach, and you know, I don't think that we necessarily went into it intending to do it this way. It just sort of is how it shook out. But because we never took any sort of outside investment or outside capital or, you know, anything of that kind, we never had to answer to anybody. Like, the final say on everything we've ever done is the eight founders, and there's no investor to please. There's no authority who can say no. And I think because of that, we've been able to get away with things that most companies could sort of never dream of doing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like what?
Oh, sending people poop in the mail. Yeah. things like digging, you know, the hole we dug last year. I think that you know, we lost an egregious amount of money on that project. Like people have very little sort of awareness of how much it costs to do sort of a big construction project that's live streamed like that. But you know, any normal company would look at the sort of the revenue situation with that and be like, why on earth would we, this is a terrible idea. And also people are going to hate it. It makes you look weird. Like why would we do this? But since at the end of the day, most of what we're trying to do is just kind of make each other laugh in the way we have been since we were kids. Like if we think it's funny and it makes us laugh, we do it. And then
also that's what we do. I mean, Cards in general doesn't pay for advertising. So, you know, there's a couple of exceptions of we've done some like podcast ads and stuff, but we don't do like, you know, we don't like pay for like Facebook ads or billboards. I don't really know what other companies do, to be honest, but I know that they spend all this money on advertising, and it's sort of weird to me to even imagine that working. But we like to do these like big stunts that are like earned media, right? That people talk about because they're funny or they're interesting. And, you know, occasionally we have to collaborate with some other big company to make the stunt happen. So like an example was we did a Black Friday sale a couple of years ago where we took down our whole store and we weren't selling anything. We completely took Cards Against Humanity offline, and the whole day was just give Cards Against Humanity $5. And it was like, you know, I think the copy was like the best thing you can buy on Black Friday is nothing. And we're selling that for the low price of only $5. And you can buy nothing for $5, you know, right here. And we called Amazon and we were like, hey, listen, we're doing this joke and we want you to take Cards Against Humanity offline on Black Friday. And Amazon was like, are you crazy? They were like, you know, that's like a big sales day, right? And we're like, we know, it's funny though. But, you know, it wound up being this whole debate with them of like, if we were allowed to do that and whether it was a good idea. And it's like, it was just a reminder of like, well, for us, once we started laughing about how funny it would be to sell nothing on Black Friday, and once we sort of felt how right that joke felt for us, we didn't think twice about taking our store down. But then as soon as we had to go to this other company that's, you know, more, I don't know, more traditional or corporate or has better judgment or whatever you want to call it.
They have people that are financially beholden to, you know.
That's fun. How has your sense of humor changed over the years, or at least even through the time that Cards Against Humanity has been with us?
Well, I don't know that my sense of humor, that's an interesting question that I've never really thought about like, does a person's sense of humor change throughout their lifetime? I mean, I'm sure it has, but I couldn't tell you how. But I think one thing that's definitely changed is, we've become really aware of the fact that we sort of made this thing that has taken a place in popular culture. So writing a joke that just makes Ben laugh or makes my friends laugh, it has a really different feeling to it than writing jokes that like millions of people are going to see. And it's going to go out into all of these, you know, college campuses and places all over the world. So it has sort of made us approach the game with like our ear to the ground of trying to understand any joke we write. How are people going to take this? Is someone going to feel bullied by this? Are they going to feel excluded from the game? Are they going to feel like people are laughing at them with this joke? And, you know, we have this like extensive playtesting program. We collect all this data. We try to be really mindful of like how any joke that we write is going to be received in the popular culture. And you know, we try to make sure that we're fulfilling our responsibility back to the people who want to open the game and laugh, right? No one wants to open the game and feel bad.
Sure. No, of course. There have been jokes that have been the cards have evolved though over time, right? There's been certain types of topics that you guys have sort of ferreted out because of those reasons, right? We thought you kind of rethought their role in the deck, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, we get together every year and we actually review every single card in publication. And at this point, Ben, how many cards are in the like official Cards Against Humanity ecosystem?
I mean, on the order of 2,000.
Yeah, so it's gotten to be quite a big project. And we collect like huge amounts of data on every card, all these playtests, in-person playtests, online playtests, like all, we have just so much information about these cards. And then we sit down every year and we go over every single card one by one in the game. And we argue about, is it still culturally relevant? Like we used to have this Britney Spears joke, and we were like, well, she's not really relevant anymore. So then for a while we made it like a Miley Cyrus joke, but now I feel like Miley Cyrus doesn't quite have the same place in the culture that she did a few years ago. And so then this year we had like a big argument about should it be a Zendaya joke or not. Now we're now that everyone's old. So I was like, oh, what about Zendaya? And everyone was like, who's Zendaya? And I was like, so we spend a lot of, and then we Google, and then we have to go on Google and we're like, how many results are there for Zendaya? Is she like actually a celebrity? So that's sort of like, we go down those rabbit holes and times 2000, right? Like we just sit there for days just going through every single card. And we look at a variety of factors of like, is it relevant? How's it being received? Do people get the point of view that we're trying to come across with this card? Do they, are they laughing at it? We also look at, for any white card, we look at the black cards it's played with. And for any black card, we look at the white cards it's played with. So we see, do people get this joke? Are they using it in the right way? Like if we write a political joke, are they using it in a political context? And are they completing the punchline in like funny ways? Or are they just sort of randomly mashing this up with other cards? And that's often a sign that the joke, that people are not responding to the joke and they don't like it. So we look at all that data and then we have an argument over how much to use the data. And then when that's done, we take maybe about 30% of the game out year over year and replace cards and change them. So we just upgraded the game to Cards Against Humanity 2.0. And that's like, I think like since we started working on cards, like probably more than 75% of the game is completely new.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. And what surprised you in that process?
I mean, I think as we've sort of moved out of the Obama era and into the Trump era of America, there has been a little bit of a shift in the tone of the game that I think was reflected in a lot of the edits we made for Cards Against Humanity 2.0, sort of away from like this general dark nihilism and towards more of a sort of like Dadaist absurdity, which is I think increasingly reflective of the world. I feel like the first part of that was really the Black Friday stunt we did last year where we just dug a hole.
You know what's crazy about the hole was that it was we've been talking about that for years and it was always just I always thought the hole was,
we thought it was way too far out there that people wouldn't get it. It wouldn't be
right. We always thought it was, we always basically thought it was random, right? That, hey, we're going to go dig this hole. Isn't that random? And it kind of lacked a purpose. And that, I mean, we had it on the back burner for years of like a thing we could do someday. But then after the Trump election, it took on this whole other power, right? Of like this, it just meant something that it didn't mean before. And it became this visual that like so resonated with so many people. Like I probably have gotten more comments about the hole and what it meant to people. And like, wow, you guys really tapped into something dark there than almost any project that we've ever done. But, oh, I know the other thing I was going to throw out that's surprising about the big 2.0 update is like, we thought, you know, I think there's this take out there that you hear of like, oh, well, Trump, like he's probably going to like fuck up the country and ruin a bunch of people's lives. And, drag us back 100 years, but he'll be really good for comedy, right? Like Trump's going to be great for comedy. Like all these comedians must be so excited that that Trump is in there. What a great opportunity! And like the truth is, it's not actually that good. I was pretty surprised at how difficult it is to write jokes about Donald Trump. The first thing is, I think most comedians are mostly just worried about their like health insurance and their loved ones being deported, and they're not really thinking about what a great joke they can make. So it's just people are in a bad mood all the time now, and they're kind of stressed all the time about what crazy shit the president might say on Twitter. But the second thing is, Trump, he's just a uniquely difficult public figure to satirize. Like, number one, the guy does not have a sense of humor. Like, can you imagine him laughing, like really laughing at something?
It's unimaginable.
So it's hard, you know. Obama, you could kind of make fun of him because he was in on the joke, right? He did jokes about eating 7 almonds and stuff.
Well, he was self-aware. Trump has no self-awareness.
Right. And that's exactly right. And like Trump has no shame and he has no dignity and no self-awareness. So any joke you do just feeds into his brand. It's just, you're just like hurling like food at him and he eats it and gets bigger. It's like, you know, he's like some sort of like demon or something. But the other thing is, you know, typically when you satirize a public figure, you try and find something absurd or you know, comical or farcical about them. And then you exaggerate it to an unrealistic degree, right? So Obama was kind of professorial, and the seven almonds thing stuck because it's just like so persnickety and precise and disciplined. It's like to the point of parody that that was such a funny joke about him. What could you posit about Trump that's exaggerated more than something he would actually do? Like, I have trouble. I can't imagine it. Like, if I don't think I could have written a joke that was like, Trump's going to go to the Boy Scouts and make a political speech about how many electoral college votes he got. That's fucking insane. Like, you could never come up. You can never be a step ahead of the guy because he'll always be crazier than you can posit.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's interesting, and I think it's especially interesting when it comes to sort of like the how that sort of translates to the cards, right? Because I think when people think about what Cards Against Humanity is, they aren't really thinking about the words on the cards. They just think that magically they just are there. They didn't think that somebody was like writing them.
You know, I think one of the things that sets cards apart from some of the like imitators or other stuff that's out there is I think we're more editorial. So like when you read our game, like I think that our point of view comes across a little bit. I also think that's been really helpful in terms of like getting being able to connect with an audience.
I think what's also interesting for you guys, so there's a lot of your game, right, isn't necessarily like protectable in a lot of the ways that we might think. Toys in general are easy to sort of copy, right? You guys have a Creative Commons license. You encourage people to download. There's no patents on the mechanics of the game. You know, it's a very classic thing. You've got black and white cards, you've got Helvetica type, you know. And so it's this interesting thing, right? Because yeah, there's going to be copycats. And you guys also sort of like encourage people to sort of like remix the sets, kind of do their own thing. You know, why is that still so important even now?
Why is what so? I must have missed part of the question.
To sort of like encourage people to sort of take freedom with the game.
Do you mean like, oh, with respect to the Creative Commons license and yeah, all of that? I mean, the obvious point here is it doesn't matter what you say or do, people will pirate and use your stuff however they want. I mean, that's the world we live in. So, you know, for all the games out there that don't release under a Creative Commons license, or they try and exact some control over like how people play or whether they put it on YouTube or how they remix it or what they do with it, I mean, you know, good fucking luck. It's never going to work. So you might as for, I think there was a certain law, and then there was the issue of when we started cards, like we couldn't afford lawyers. We didn't know what we were doing. So there was this idea that, well, we may as well just sort of, this is going to happen to us anyway. We may as well just lean into it. Like everyone else tries to like, you know, everyone else is like, you know, I just watched the Ken Burns Vietnam documentary, so that's all I can think about. But it's like, you see all these big companies and they're like dying on this hill. They're just trying to take this hill, and the Viet Cong comes crawling out of the woods and just decimates them. And then it's like, but you can't give up the hill because you have a point to prove. And then finally you take the thing and everyone else like, you know, the Viet Cong like melts back into the jungle and you're just left with this hill that you didn't want. That's all these like awful protracted IP battles that people have. So we just felt like there must be an easier way to just not have to have this insane battle with our fans. And the Creative Commons license was a great tool. It was free. It was easy to understand. It was kind of surprising and progressive to people. And I think it probably helped with the marketing that like there were people out there who felt like they weren't going to get in trouble if they put the game on YouTube or promoted it or put it on Instagram or whatever.
I mean, it was also available exclusively as a free download for almost 2 years when we first released it. And it became sort of very, very closely intertwined with our whole brand. I think a lot of people these days actually don't know that we have a Creative Commons license on a lot of the content, and you can download and print the game for free at home, but you still can.
Yeah. It's interesting. And there have been some key times where you guys have said, hey, you know what, we need to sort of step forward. And this is something that we need to, we need to protect this element, you know? And that also kind of comes down to the editorial, right? You know, tell me like when it's important, like why you guys have stepped in when you have.
I mean, it comes down to, you know, if someone is doing something that sort of purports to be Cards Against Humanity but isn't Cards Against Humanity, that's when we have to step in and do something. And that's just a basic reality of the way that copyright and trademark law work in America, is if someone is using your brand without your permission, or they're presenting your brand in a way that you don't approve of, you have to fight it. And so we limit our, we really hate doing that stuff. we do an absolute minimum.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in my second week of my intellectual property class in law school, so I feel like I can address this as an expert.
But, clearly.
But basically, when you get a trademark on your name, the trademark is it's intended to be a source identifier, meaning that hearing the name Cards Against Humanity, seeing our distinctive black and white look, or the typography of our game, or any of the million things that indicate that it's the special thing that we make, it identifies the source of the game, which is, it's by Ben and I, right? We're putting our seal of approval on it. And there's lots of comedy writing out there. There's lots of card games, but this is ours. This is the one where if you buy it, you know that you're getting our sense of humor and our editorial judgment, and you're getting all of the fun stunts and craziness that we do that go along with the game. So I think the times where we've wound up in some sort of like legal battle with people are where they sort of step on our rights to the name Cards Against Humanity or our distinctive look as a source identifier, meaning they try to make their thing look so much like Cards Against Humanity that people naturally assume that it's us. So if people like name their, they'll change like one word and then make a ripoff game, or like literally knock off our whole game, like literally use all of our writing and then resell it. And it's like, well, usually what we do then is we write them an email and we say, hey, please don't do this. And then if they continue to do it, then it becomes a legal issue, and we crush them and ruin their livelihood.
Well, and I think anybody would agree with you that all of that makes perfect sense, and that would be very reasonable for you to do. And I think what's really interesting about what you guys do, and you guys, you know, please correct me if I'm thinking about this in the wrong way. There's been a lot of parts of the way that you guys sort of approach the company that just sort of an atypical thing, right? Like you do things that you're not, you know, are going to be are going to lose money. You dug a great big hole in the ground, right? You went to a trade show and did sort of like a pay what you want, put a pay up what you want sign up, and folks who may have not heard this story, basically people could just take the games, and it was sort of another one of those stunts, but it was an expensive stunt, right? Because it cost, you know, many thousands of dollars, right? That, you know, you guys didn't sell those games, right? It was the worth of that. So like $34,000 worth of games that people were, that you guys would have, profit that you guys would have lost, right? And so when you're folks that are maybe not as worried about maybe a cost benefit analysis, right? But it's the creativity part that you're like, hey, you know, like let's, You sit up a little straighter. To me, it seems like that's what really distinguishes your company, that you and your just approach to Cards Against Humanity and what you've built, right? That you are really protective about, you're more protective about the creative than you are about necessarily some spreadsheet.
The brand has always been number one. The brand, the experience, the sort of the way we interact with customers has always been a lot more important to us than doing whatever's going to make us the most money. I mean, I think if we wanted to do whatever would make us the most money, we would have done a whole bunch of really lame, shitty stuff the last few years, a whole lot of t-shirts and TV shows. And,
that's what I always say is like, if you ever see a Cards Against Humanity release a t-shirt, like that's, we've sold out. That's it. We're like cashing in. We're done.
Or an iPhone game for kids, you know, Angry Birds
that's
collaboration.
Actually a good idea. No, that's actually a good idea. Yeah.
Marketing to kids, you know, that's one, you know, the game is very, it's very adult. And we have talked about trying to do a version of it that's modified to be able to be played by kids.
You know, there's one. So, I mean, this is another question that we get asked often in interviews of like, oh, why are you guys so unusual in the decisions that you make or whatever? And like, you know, in a way, it's weirder to me that everyone else has this sort of heterodoxy about how to run a company and how to market things. Like like everyone acknowledges that the world is changing really quickly, and that the internet has sort of supplanted a lot of the like traditional ways of doing things. But then like, there's still these, like, I guess like a lot of MBAs out there with like checklists who are like, well, you've got to do these 8 things to promote your product and have a successful launch and a social media strategy and all of that. So, I mean, I guess I feel like why are we the weird ones? Like, why isn't the normal thing that you like?
Right. I mean, nothing feels weird when we're
doing it. Feels natural, man.
Right. Well, no, it does. Right. Cause we look at we assess the battlefield and we like look at our options in terms of like materially, like what can we do? And then we come up with the best plan with the resources at hand and send our people into war. Like that's the normal thing that you do. Like, well, I don't like, I mean, it's like a funny, like, I mean, it's like, this is like a thing that like, you read in like Sun Tzu, right? Sun Tzu's like, most people don't like deeply understand why they do the tactics that they do. They just see other people do these tactics and then they copy them. But tactics should be like downstream from strategy. Like you have to have some sort of broader strategy that informs the decisions that you make. And, ours is definitely, you know, we try and get earned media, get people's attention with funny and surprising things. And then the tactics are completely mutable from day to day. Like we don't really care what other people do out there. We're just interested in like, well, what can we do this week to be funny?
Yeah. We also try to keep the actual structure and financials of the business sort of as straightforward as we can. We sell directly on Amazon. We don't sell to Amazon. You're buying from us when you buy it on Amazon. We have our own agreements with Target and Barnes and Noble and the other retailers that we work with. We don't go through any sort of middlemen or distributors. And you know, at the end of the day, we try to control almost everything about the business and sort of, you know, the same way we haven't accepted any sort of outside financial assistance. We don't really use any outside help for almost anything we do. Try to keep it all inside so nobody can say no.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Then you're able to keep your independence.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very good. Well, that's unfortunately, fellas, that's all the time that we have. But I want to thank you both for taking the time and for all of your insights and for chatting with me. Thank you very much.
Of course.
Absolutely.
You're welcome. It was fun.
Very good. And for our listeners, a reminder that How Success Happens comes out weekly. To make sure you don't miss a single episode, subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And don't be afraid to leave us...
But wait a minute. Don't subscribe on Stitcher, though. I mean, honestly, use a normal podcast app. Get Overcast or something. Don't use Stitcher.
Or Overcast. A fine thing. I appreciate it. Overcast.
Who listens to podcasts on Stitcher?
Stitcher listeners. And please leave us a review. It helps us improve and reach more listeners just like you. For more stories just like this one on the mindset that you need to start and grow a business, go to entrepreneur.com. And to let me know what you think about the show, find me on Twitter. My hashtag is at Linda Lacina. That's @LINDALACINA. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.